danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 174 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Atlanta, Georgia. This is Carlos Welch, and I'm here with Nate Mavis from
Somerville, Massachusetts. Yeah, Somerville, Massachusetts, as usual, which is basically Boston.
Right.
Boston's a funny place. The suburbs of it are part of it in the way that suburbs of other places are not parts of those places. How are you doing these days?
I'm pretty good. Pretty good. Can't complain.
I had thought that you might be somewhere in the middle of the country by now, getting out to the World Series. But that's not the case. Are you headed out soon?
Well, today is the 24th, and my niece graduates from high school on the 27th. So okay. I'm staying in town for her graduation, and
fantastic.
I'm leaving the very next day. So I will be gassing up the Knitmobile on the 28th and driving from Atlanta to Las Vegas.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations to your niece, and please be safe as you're driving.
Yes, I will. I will.
Do you have big plans for the drive, or are you just going straight through?
I'm going to drive maybe, I plan to take like a week to get out there.
Okay.
And I'm going to maybe drive 5 hours a day. And okay. So I've planned stops in several places along the way. Probably the biggest will be in, I'm taking 40. So I'm going to go through Oklahoma City. Okay. And once I get to Oklahoma City, instead of continuing to drive west, I'm going to take a detour south to hopefully meet my buddy Mario Silvestri at Choctaw.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. So this is one of the Shipaholic Ballers, if the listeners are familiar with that story, that I met on a trip to Dallas with the Sassanato last year. And so it'll be pretty cool to, visit him while I'm in his neck of the woods.
And he's still in poker. So when I think Shipaholic Ballers, I think Raptor and Durr. And I guess Durr is still in poker, but in his own way. And Raptor, I don't know what he's up to. But Mario is still living the life.
Yes, he's still in poker. In fact, I want to say, if I remember the story correctly, he and Raptor were like, they grew up together and they were like roommates in like college or high school or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he's definitely still in poker. And I got to be careful because he's a proud Italian. And okay. He got onto me for saying Mario, which is the way I learned it from the video game.
Sure.
But he told me it's pronounced Mario.
Mario.
So I try to, try to respect his name, and I try to work on that. Got to put some respect on it.
All right. I definitely would have gotten that wrong. Wait, so what about Dario Minieri? Should I be saying Dario?
That's a good question.
Would you mind asking?
I will. I will ask him, because I would have said Dario. I can't even. Dario. Yeah, I definitely would have said Dario. I would have said Dario. So yeah. I'm confused. Yeah.
So the two of us met, I guess, 3 years ago now at the World Series, and you were playing a lot of satellites and living the TPE life out there, like doing what you could to rail good players, get to know good players, do things that would build your bankroll responsibly, do hilarious things like walking around Binion's late at night. and as the years have gone by, you've had a remarkably consistent and prudent approach to all this. And you're approach to Las Vegas over the summers has been pretty similar, playing high value tournaments and doing what you can socially with TPE, expanding your network and trying to improve. Is that still what you're doing this year?
Yes. Yes. My last year was actually a slight departure from that plan because, in April of last year, I won the Sunday major on, Bovada.
Yep.
And so I had some online success and I kind of, you know, wanted to move up a little bit. So I started playing slightly higher buy-in tournaments and ended up playing the main event last year and was fortunate enough to cash in that. Mm-hmm. So that's the good news. The bad news is I played a 1K and a 1500, didn't cash in those and didn't really enjoy them. Okay. So this year, I'm going to go back to the original plan, which is to play very few, if any, WSOP events and continue doing my Binions grind and you know, whatever tournaments that don't involve other decent players. That's what I that's what I want to get back to, because I was winning a lot back then and making frequent final tables makes me happy, and I'd rather do that than play a tournament with a higher buy-in and probably like a higher expected value or, you know, expected hourly rate. Sure. I'd rather forgo the long run just so I can win more often today.
Sure. And that's partly a happiness decision and partly also a variance decision. Like, you need a much smaller bankroll to play tournaments with the same buy-in and same percentage edge if the field is smaller, right?
Yes, yes. Definitely a happiness consideration. And more importantly, I'm not a professional poker player, so I don't have to make the highest value decision in situations where I'm foregoing some happiness because of it. So if I was a professional poker player and I had, you know, tons of bills, then, you know, it wouldn't make a lot of sense for me to play $100, $200 live tournaments. But because I live in a van, I can basically do all the hell I want to. And this is what I want to do. So it's what I'm going to do.
So on your Twitch stream, it says that you are a professional poker student. Is that how you think of yourself now?
Yes, that's how I think of myself. And basically what I mean by that is I would at this point, it may even be more, but I'll say close to 50-50 amount of time spent studying versus playing. And so basically I make money by studying poker and then writing about writing articles to share with my readers what I've learned. And I do make money when I play poker also, but I don't consider that my primary source of income.
Yeah, that's interesting. There are a lot of interesting things about that. One of them is that there are these old sort of paradoxes in ethics where they say, like, if you're a hedonist, if your goal is to just experience the most pleasure that you can over the course of your life, it's pretty bad to believe that. So there's this like paradox of hedonism where the thing that you do that makes you, that gets you the most pleasure is to come to believe that helping other people is the best thing you can do in life. And then you ultimately wind up experiencing much more pleasure that way. And I wonder if there isn't something similar going on in your case, because you don't think of yourself as a professional poker player. But if I didn't have a plan of getting a normal 9-to-5 job, I think that spending roughly half my time studying would be one of the best things that I could do. Like, it seems that you're doing close to exactly what you should be doing if you considered yourself a professional poker player. I guess, do you see this as a difference in perspective? Like, in the long term, do you think you're going to be a student forever, or do you see yourself transitioning into more of a poker pro, traditionally speaking, later?
I would like to always consider myself a student. And if I was going to do anything professional wise in poker, is I would hope to like coach poker one day as opposed to playing as my primary source of income, because even with it being like a partial source of my income, it causes me to pull my hairs out of my head. So if that was all I had to look forward to in terms of generating an income, I wouldn't want to do it. And this is even if I was like a very good player. Like if I was good enough to beat, say, like 5-10 live cash games for like a very significant hourly rate, I wouldn't want to do it, because that seems like it bores me to tears a lot of times. And to me, there's just more to life than, you know, doing the thing that makes you the most money. Yeah. So, yeah, I got to enjoy it. Whatever I do in poker, I got to enjoy it first. And then, you know, if I make money from it, great. If I lose a little bit of money, that's fine also, because there's some entertainment value in it for me. But at the end of the day, I just want to be happy.
Fantastic. So we will talk more about that. But we're very grateful for our sponsors. And you talked about game selection in Las Vegas. And that leads into our Shot Clock ad here. Like most poker players, you're probably trying to nail down that perfect schedule for this year's World Series of Poker. Don't waste time hunting down schedules and spreadsheets or relying on social media when you have all that information right at your fingertips with Shark Clock. Starting this summer, Shark Clock is here to help you plan the best summer poker trip for your bankroll by easily finding the events you want to play and letting you save them on your iPhone or Android device. No ads and no login required. Download the free Shark Clock in the App Store, Google Play, or sharkclock.com.
Thanks. Thanks, Shark Clock. That's used to be one of the things I would write my articles about.
Yeah.
So Shark Clock has undercut me in the market. Thanks, guys.
Wait, but you can benefit from this too. Like in theory, you know, like you want to know where a tournament is at Binion's, you know, if Shark Clock works as it's supposed to, and in my limited testing, it certainly does. You just pull out your phone and you know where all the tournaments are that day. So, you know, part of it is Shark Clock taking your job away.
Yes.
But Shark Clock is making other parts of your job easier, I suppose.
I agree with that. And I'm sure they would do a much better job than I did on it. I never heard of it actually until you read the ad. So I'm looking forward to checking it out later today.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, and I will be using it when I get out to Las Vegas. Cool. So speaking of things that you don't want to be like work, how's Twitch going? I'm a little bit, I know Andrew likes to say that you were hesitant to Twitch for a while because that was a little bit too much like a normal job, but reliably several times a week I get these email notifications saying that Carlos Welch has gone live on Twitch, and that seems to be something that you can do reliably without pulling your hair out. So how's that going?
Define reliably, because my original plan was to do this 3 days a week. And then I dropped it to 2 days a week. And then recently, and I didn't even make an announcement about this, I just did it. And I guess that's like, that kind of goes into it not being a job, because I can just change my schedule on a whim. Yeah. But basically, I just erased the schedule from my Twitch page. And now I'm just going to do it whenever I feel like doing it. So, and I didn't have to check with a boss or anything on that. So that's pretty cool. I was supposed to do it today actually, and I didn't, because I have a lot of stuff to do to prepare for this trip across the country. And so yeah, if I'll put it this way, if Twitch was as much of a job as I initially thought it was gonna be, I would have been fired a long time ago.
Yeah, sounds good. So is this having bad financial consequences for you? Are you making less money than you did before off of Twitch? Or
Twitch has never been a major moneymaker for me. I don't, and part of that is the consistency. I'm not as consistent with it as a lot of the bigger Twitch streamers who have made it a primary income generator for them. But again, I just happiness first. And so when I feel like twitching, I will. And if I don't, I won't.
Okay. So when I jump in there, it seems like a pretty happening place. It looks like you've got a little community there and people are chatting. And I think you're very, very good at it. I think the format suits you really well, as I've said before. And it seems like a really well sort of functioning Twitch channel.
Thank you. I do enjoy it. And I do agree that I try to make it fun and I try to differentiate myself from the other streamers because I know I'm not ever going to be one of the best players on Twitch. And so I always advise people not to come to my stream to learn poker strategy. I'll tell you what I think, but I always give the caveat that I'm not a professional poker player. So I always refer people to Tournament Poker Edge if they want to learn tournament strategy. But if they want to hear me talk about hip hop or if they want to see me play and like tell stories from my life or stories of living in a van, my Twitch stream is the place to be for that. But poker is like secondary on my stream.
That makes sense. So I just got into a little bit of a disagreement on Twitter. Can I ask a professional poker student's opinion on a hand?
Sure, let's do it.
So you are, and neither one of us is actually in this position, but let's say you're at the final table of the PokerStars $10,000 scoop high main event. There are 7 players left. The stacks are, you are in the small blind with 9 big blinds. You're the shortest stack. The button has 13 big blinds. Button's the second shortest stack. The big blind has 23 big blinds and is one of a few medium stacks. And then there are 2 much bigger stacks. So let's repeat, 7-handed, 2 bigger stacks, 3 medium stacks of 20 to 25 big blinds. You are the short stack in the small blind with 9 big blinds. The button is the second shortest stack with 13 big blinds. The pay structure, there's $1.5 million for first, $1 million for second. $1.5 million for first, $1 million for second, $800,000 for third, $600,000 for fourth, $400,000 for fifth, $340,000 for sixth, $250,000 for seventh, $180,000 for eighth, and $100,000 for ninth. But we already have the $250,000 locked up.
Okay.
So all that. It folds around to the button, and the button moves all in for his 13 big blinds. You have ace-7 offsuit in the small blind. What do you do?
I fold, and I pray that the big blind busts this guy. Because what's the pay jump here?
the pay jump is 250 to 330, $85,000.
I'm probably gonna fold again. I always give the caveat. I don't know if this is correct or not, but I know if this was a real situation and I was in it, I would fold without a question.
Sure. And I thought that, so for me, this is like an easy fold too, or at least a straightforward fold. It might be wrong. I don't know, but I would fold. I guess I'm talking about what seems like a very, very easy spot for a few reasons. Okay. One is that there's not that much consensus about what to do. I talked to some good players about this. They said some different things from each other and different things from what I thought. And second is that the way I thought to go about tackling this question is it doesn't give an answer straightforwardly. So here's what I thought that I should do.
Okay.
Is pretend I call, then see what the dollar value of my stack is if I lose. That's zero. I mean, relative to seventh place.
Right.
And also see what the dollar value of my stack is if I win. And that's whatever it is. So to do that, you need an ICM calculator to figure out what the value of your, roughly 19, 20 big blind stack is if you win. 20 big blind stack. Oh, there are ANSIs too. The ANSIs are an eighth of the big blind.
Okay.
That's fine, but different ICM calculators seem to calculate it differently. And so like Leo Wolpert pointed me to a tool that gave a different answer from a tool I was using. So I'm just going to write my own ICM calculator. So I guess that's like the first lesson, is that ICM calculators sometimes disagree, I guess. And maybe we don't know as much as we thought we did about how to value stacks seven-handed at final tables. And another thing that I think is interesting about this hand is that we still have like a 20 big blind stack who just paid a big blind, or like a 22 big blind stack directly to our left, even if we double up. So one of the traditional arguments for calling a little bit looser than just an immediate equity calculation would suggest is that future hands are worth more if we can double up our stack. So I mean, the way this sort of dialectic usually goes is that, you know, you do the calculation and you see which has more or less dollar EV at the moment. Right. And then somebody comes along and says, wait, but you should actually fold a little bit more because the button, playing the button has positive value and playing the cutoff has positive value. So instead of comparing this decision to zero EV, you should be comparing it to the slightly positive EV situation that you're about to get. Then somebody else comes back and says, well, but that positive EV situation gets even more positive EV if you have doubled up already. So it's not right to say that the button is a benefit if you don't double up, or because it's also a benefit. And in fact, it's a bigger benefit if you do double up. And here, the only thing I want to say is that, like, that's all well and good. But if we double up to 20 big blinds, we've got a 20 big blind stack directly to our left. And that's going to put us in, like, not a world of pain, but it's going to cause some trouble for us, because that's a great reshove stack. And all the ICM pressure we're under now, that's not going to go away. Exactly. So, like, I mean, whenever we open, we're going to have these sort of, like, you know, bloodthirsty people, opponents to our left, just ready to pounce on all our opens. I mean, of course, we want to double up. We would like to double up. That's great. But it's not like we get some sort of playing advantage bonanza from doing so, especially since the player to our right is shorter stacked. In that case, well, I guess in that case, we have an extremely short stacked player to our immediate right. So we also get a reshoving stack, but conversely, other people can reshove against us. And that's a long way of saying that this seems like an extremely elementary situation, but very good players are disagreeing about it. And that makes me think that poker is not completely dead if we don't know exactly what to think about it. Do you have any reactions to anything I just said?
I agree with everything you just said. I agree with. And the main thing I would add, and this is just like a general rule that I use that, again, I don't know if it's correct, but when I'm in ICM situations like this, I lean more towards shoving in spots as mm-hmm. opposed to calling. So yeah. I may purposely call slightly tighter than I'm supposed to in this spot, because I feel like with nine big blinds, we still have a decent amount of fold equity on the other 20-ish big blind stacks at the table. So, yeah. I mean, if I'm sitting here with like five bigs, I'll call. But,
yeah,
you know, when I can pretty much threaten close to half of another player's stack where they're not going to just be calling me super liberally, I'm willing to pass up on these spots. Yeah. So that's probably my first reaction to looking at this spot.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, for whatever it's worth, if people want an answer, if you put this hand to me, like, now, I would probably call with, like, medium pairs and better, and a hand like ace-jack or better. Yeah, like, ish. Does that sound about right to you?
I was thinking about this myself, and I'm thinking, like, ace-10 suited would be, like, the very, very bottom of my side call range. Like, I'm not sure. Even happy with that. As far as pairs, sixes feel a little dirty. Like, sevens just is what it is. So, like, I feel like the bottom of my range that I'm somewhat confident in would be, like, ace-10 suited plus and sixes. And I may even shave off the bottom of that just because I'd rather be shoving than calling in situations like this.
Yeah. And by the way, just as a teaser, I'm going to look at this hand more. I have some suspicions that a correct range might be, like, much, much tighter than that. Like, if somebody came up to me and told me that ace-queen was a fold, I'm not sure I'd believe it, but, like, I think it's more likely that ace-queen is a fold than that ace-six offsuit is a call. How about that?
I agree with that. But, I mean, it doesn't surprise me because I've studied somewhat the effects of ICM on big bubbles like this. And so I know how tight you're supposed to call in spots, but it's more so when there's a shorter stack and you're a medium stack but when you're the small stack, the smallest stack, I would be shocked if the ICM considerations were such that you would have to fold ace queen as the short stack. That would be surprising. So I'm very interested to find out if that's the case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, step one is writing my own ICM calculator.
Yes. Just because, easy enough. Yeah.
Which I think should be easy. I mean, I think it's just like a recursive. I think it's a pretty straightforward recursive algorithm. So I think I can do that, like, over dinner tonight. I mean, watch me be wrong. But
I think back to Nate Silver when he talked about making his snap shove. How he thought it was going to be like, it shouldn't be that hard. Then it took him like 6 months or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, no, I'm not saying, I mean, I make software. This is one of the worlds I'm in. And you can just like quadruple anything that any time estimate. It's
gotcha.
there's something called Hofstadter's Law, which is that any project takes longer than you think it'll take, even when you take into account Hofstadter's Law.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's a sort of a pessimistic self-referential formula. So that's one hand I wanted to talk about, and it's very simple, and maybe some of you think it is too boring to talk about, but I don't know the right answer, and a lot of people I talk to don't know the right answer, and a lot of money can be on the line when you're making that decision. So I think it's worth giving it some thought. And Carlos, not to put you on the spot, but Tournament Poker Edge is also bringing us the podcast. And would you care to say anything about the virtues of Tournament Poker Edge, or should I?
Always love saying good things about Tournament Poker Edge because, you know, it's done so much for me. I don't have anything prepared, so I'll just, you know, speak from the heart. But I mean, I feel like I've said this so many times, but this is what I will say. This year, for the first time in Vegas, TPE will have a booth in the halls of the Rio. So I will be working the booth this year. And I can remember coming to Vegas for the first time and meeting the TPE guys in 2013 and just how those guys welcomed me with open arms from day one. Like I was a member of the site for a year. And so I kind of knew some of the guys from just on the forums and everything, but you don't really expect like instant friendships when you meet people in person. that you've been studying poker from online. I don't want to use poker as an example right here. This might be a long ad, by the way. I can't think of a this I know I'm not doing a great job here, but let's say Tony Robbins. If I was studying Tony Robbins materials, I don't think if I went to one of his events, we would be like instant friends and he's going to invite me back to, like, you know, spend the night at his place and everything when I didn't have a place to stay in Vegas. But TPE did that. And so the hospitality that they showed me from day one when I'm in the booth, because I will be working the booth part of the time in Vegas this year. I just want to pay that forward. So, yeah, when I'm in the booth this year in Vegas at the Tournament Poker Edge booth, if any other members see me in the hall, they should stop by and talk to me so that I can pay for the same hospitality that the TPE guys showed me when I first met them in Vegas. And
And yeah. So good. So Turner Poker Edge, a great community. There's good strategy on the site. It's great place to learn poker, in your opinion. Yes.
Yes, and you know what? That's actually a testament to TPE and the guys. The quality of the people that run the site is. I just did like a 5-minute ad for TPE, and I never mentioned poker once. It's just like. It's like probably the biggest thing about the community that sets them apart is the relationships that you build. And they definitely have very great poker instructors like Andrew Brokus and also Nate Mavis now. But it's easier to learn poker from people when you know them. It's like I'm excited to watch the new Nate series, because it's not like, you know, me listening to Professor Mavis. It's me listening to my friend Nate. And that's not something that I get on a lot of other training sites. So that definitely adds a lot to it. It's like the instruction is there, but more important than the high quality instruction is the students' willingness to receive it. And when you build relationships with people, they want to learn from you. As a teacher, one of the first things that I learned was students don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I know that the people at Tournament Poker Edge care about me more so than just, you know, a dollar amount on the income statement.
Well, fantastic. I think that was a good ad, and I think that if this whole poker thing doesn't work out, you can look into a career in those like long form infomercials that you get on cable on Sunday mornings. You know what I'm talking about?
yeah.
I feel like I might buy a juicer from you if I can see.
That's awesome.
So let's see. There was another hand here. I mean, if. I've got another hand from a listener. If you don't have a hand you want to talk about or anything else poker related that you want to talk about.
Let's do the hand. I got something funny that I can share with everybody real quick.
Yeah. Do that.
So I was a little under the weather this weekend. And so I decided to give myself to boost my immune system by taking some vitamin C and zinc. And I continued that today, but I hadn't eaten anything yet. And for some reason, I got online and I just noticed something online that, like, in capital letters, never take zinc on an empty stomach. And so I clicked on it and I started reading it, and it's apparently like horrible, horrible symptoms if you do that, if you take zinc on an empty stomach, which I did. So immediately I just started eating everything I could find, trying to, like, you know, I don't know, like, what's the time, like, well, like, how long do you have to, like, you know, for your, how long does your stomach have to be empty before, you know, you get all these horrible effects? But I think I made it. So yeah. I ate a bunch of stuff and I was like, man, I hope I don't get sick on the podcast today. But I've been fine so far. Fantastic. So apparently I got that food in time.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear it. It's looks like you dodged a bullet there.
Yes, I think so. So to the listeners, never, ever, ever, ever take zinc on an empty stomach.
It also makes me slightly fear a future when Google, like if this whole Nest thing and all this automation stuff works out and the people when Google serves you ads on the internet, they might be serving you ads from people who know that you just ate zinc on an empty stomach. And I imagine that in the future, I'm going to be getting a lot more terrifying messages from advertisers who know exactly what I just have or haven't eaten.
Scary as that sounds, that would have saved me today. Yeah. Because I got super lucky. I mean, just so random that I was online and I saw that. But I read the symptoms, and this is not something that you want to ever go through. So, I'm glad. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's I'm glad you you escaped the whatever horrible things would have happened to you.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So David writes in today. David says, hi, Nate, and presumably Andrew. I'm a big fan of your podcasts. I'm in my mid-50s and have played poker all my adult life. I was consistently a winning cash game player early in the poker boom at mostly 2-5, some 5-10. In recent years, I found the games much more challenging as there are fewer really bad players. Many average players have improved through study or experience, and some pros are really tough to play against. My win rate had become negligible. So for the last 6 months, I've dedicated myself to improving my game by studying with books and videos and your podcast. Much improvement has ensued. And I would like to say thank you, David, for all that kind stuff. David has some questions about a hand. 1-3 cash game at Parks Casino. My image, I believe, is slightly more aggressive than average, yet tempered by my age. Effective stacks are 600, except Glikhodov, who has 300. Middle position limps. She is an experienced player, but opens too widely and often donk bets with any flop fit. In the hijack, I raise to $12 with pocket fours. So let's stop right there. Carlos, what are you doing with pocket fours with $600 effective stacks in a 1-3 game over a limp?
I'm probably just limping behind with fours. I generally think about what I want to happen.
Yeah.
Before I make a decision. Yeah. And when I have fours, what I most want is for somebody else to have aces. Yeah. And I want to be able to set mine against them as cheaply as possible. And raising kind of negates that benefit.
Yeah.
And in addition, small pairs aren't the best hands to, like, in a case where nobody has a big pair and set mining doesn't make a lot of sense anyway, I still would decide not to raise with fours because it's not a hand that is going to pick up a ton of equity that I can use to barrel. Mm-hmm. And generally, when I play 1-3, you don't win hands on the flop. Mm-hmm. It's going to take multiple, probably large size barrels to get people off of their holdings. And I'd rather have something that can turn like a flush or a straight draw. And fours just doesn't fit into that equation.
Yeah, that makes sense. This is a part of my game I've actually changed over the last couple of years. I now standardly limp behind with a hand like this. I think the best reason to raise is that you would like to win the largest possible pot when you hit a set. And if the player to your right, if that person has enough money and if you cover, I think that the benefits to raising start to be pretty good. However, we are 200 big blinds deep here. That's a lot, but you know, it's not really, really deep. And we are in the hijack here, so we still have four players behind us. That's a much bigger risk of getting re-raised than even if we were two positions to the left on the button. So I think that it shouldn't be too hard to build a pot if we hit a set, and especially, as you say, the best situations when we have fours are when we're up against an overpair and getting three bet. Often we have like either a fold that we don't want to make or a thin-ish set line call before the flop, and we turn a really profitable situation into a marginal one. So this is a spot where I'm limping behind now. I don't think raising is like a terrible play, especially if they're going to play badly on the flop and pay off too much when we hit a set and fold too much when we don't. It's always nice to take down a bigger pot when your opponents are over folding, but I'm now limping in this spot. So it sounds like we're agreed there.
Yes.
So, but David raises to $12. The cutoff, who is a young, tight player with pretty stringent preflop standards, calls, as does the button, who seems like an okay but not aggressive player, and his previous showdowns have been good hands. The blinds fold. The pot is roughly $50. So once again, we have a middle position limper. David raises to $12. The cutoff calls with 300. The button calls with 600, and middle position also calls with 600. The flop is ace of clubs, nine of clubs, four of spades. That's a pretty good flop. Middle position yes. leads out for $20, and David has already said that middle position often donk bets with any flop fit. So what are you doing here after middle position bets 20 into 50?
And so we have how many people call behind us? Cutoff, button.
Those two.
Just the two?
Yeah.
If they have an ace, it's probably not super strong because they didn't re-raise us. So probably capping them at around like ace queen, ace jack. And the original limper shouldn't have a ton of big aces in either. So I think there's a good chance that someone has an ace, but it's probably not that strong. I would be curious how these people play flush draws. Are they more likely to raise a flush draw in this spot? I'm trying to decide if I want to just call here to see if the players behind me, like if a guy behind me has like ace seven of hearts and it goes bet raise before it gets to him, like is that person capable of folding his ace? If so, I want to just call. Mm-hmm. Also, if they're the type of person that would raise here with clubs, I also want to just call. And for those reasons, I think I like a call here. I think the other ranges aren't strong enough to pay us off if we start putting a lot of money into the pot right away.
Yeah, I like everything you've said. In your opinion, in a 1-3 game, if middle position bets 20 and you raise to, say, 70, and the next person has 6-5 of clubs, what's that person doing?
Are they folding? Pretty good question. 6-5 of clubs here.
Yeah. So what David said is that the cutoff is a young, tight player with pretty stringent preflop standards. The button seems like an okay but not aggressive player, and his previous showdowns have been good hands, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, I think a tight player could fold 6-5 suited there if we raise. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think there should be a fair number of aces behind us. I think I can see a case for calling and for raising. I think the best reason to call is that a lot of aces will call behind us, and those are going to be aces that are likely to call the 20 but fold for 70 or whatever we raise it to. I think the best reason to raise is to get 3-bet by a flush draw. or for ace nine to go crazy. So I think ace nine we can lose action from on the turn if either a club hits or if a king queen jack hits, and that's a little bit of a problem. Also we have bottom set, so we don't block any like good aces, and 1-3 players are pretty likely to just call with ace king and ace queen, as opposed to 3-betting them. So I think I lean slightly toward a raise here, actually, but I can also see an argument for just calling.
Question for you, Nate.
Yeah.
Let's say, so I think, I wonder if I'm putting too much emphasis on the flush draws, because there shouldn't, there's not a lot of flush draws relative to the number of aces in their ranges. That's but, right. But when you say that if you raise and the guy behind you, if he has a flush draw, if he's likely to three bet with it,
yeah,
you would want to raise.
Yeah.
But my question is, would that same guy raise if we just call, which then allows us to, what would that be, a four bet?
I guess it'd be a three bet. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's a good question. And I mean, right. If we raise, I'm not sure we're likely to get, yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think yes. I think anybody who would three bet a raise with a flush draw would probably raise a bet and a call with a flush draw. I in the spot would be very tempted to raise a bet and a call with a flush draw, and I would be much less tempted to three bet a bet and a raise with a flush draw. So that's a reason to just call. I do think it's important that the ace is in the flush suit. So mm-hmm. a lot of the suited hands that people play are ace high. I think this hand changes a bit if you make the four clubs and the ace of spades, whereas it was the other way around.
Right.
That said, I mean, we're $600 deep, and we would like to win a really big pot, either from somebody who gets really stubborn with a good but not great ace, or a very good ace, or with ace nine. And because of that, I think I'm going to take a chance at winning a big pot and raise to 70. That said, I'm not sure I'm right about that. And I think this is like a pretty routine situation, and I'm a bit embarrassed. I don't have a firmer grasp on it.
Yeah, I agree. I think I would call here in most scenarios, but the fact that that's not, that we don't have a consensus on that is something that I need to look into why this isn't a more straightforward call.
Yeah. I think at 100 big blinds deep, I like a call a lot better. I just think that 200 big blinds deep, and especially in a 1-3 game, you can make a lot of money from ace queen and especially ace nine. And it's really hard to get the 600th dollar in if you don't put in more money on the flop. So that's what you might think that that's like very simplistic thinking, and in fact it is, but that's a lot of where I'm coming from. And at $300 deep, I would be much more likely to call. Okay. David agrees with you. David agrees with you. David just, so he says, with two players to act behind, I thought there was a reasonable chance of a re-raise if I just called, especially from the cutoff whose range contained a lot of big aces. The smallish size of the bet seems to invite a raise from the later to act players, either for value with a big draw or to see where I'm at. So I just called. And I like what David says here. I think maybe after somebody is raised and then it's gone bet call from the raiser, I'm not sure that players are going to see a lot of raising opportunities there. I'm not sure. I've played with a ton of 1-3 players who are going to be really raise happy in this spot, but I like his thinking nonetheless. And that's why David just calls. And the cutoff and button both called behind, which keeps it four-handed without adding much money to the pot. A really bad result, as so many hands are now alive. In re-examining the hand, I'm pretty sure not raising was a mistake, but not sure how bad of one, considering there could have been different action behind. The pot is now $130. So, to reset, middle position limps, David raises to 12 with pocket fours, cutoff calls, button calls, middle position calls. Flop comes ace of clubs, nine of clubs, four of spades. David flops a set. There's a flush draw up. The limper now bets out for 20. David calls. Both players, surprisingly, called behind. I'm surprised at that too. The pot is now $130. The turn brings the 10 of diamonds, a card that makes live a lot of straight draws in addition to the flush draw. So, well, anyway, I'll let David continue here. I feel I have to make a big bet playing four-handed, hoping to fold out hands like Broadway draws, while maybe inducing all-ins by hands like two pair, which the turn makes more likely. In any event, try to get at least heads up. After a middle position checks, I bet 150. The cutoff folds, the button hesitates and calls, middle position folds. Okay, so there's a lot to talk about there. David decides to make an over bet. He bets 150 with effective stacks of about 550 into a pot of 130. Do you? Is there anything that you'd like to say about this turn decision, Carlos?
I will say I like it, and I wouldn't be so quick to assume that this is an overbet that the opponents will identify as such, because people generally don't do a great job of keeping track of the pot size in live poker.
Yeah.
And I would assume most people would look at this as just as a pot size bet. Yeah. And I'm curious if David meant for this to be an over bet, or if he just wanted to bet roughly the size of the pot. Because I think in the minds of the opponents, it would play differently if they thought this was a pot size bet versus an over bet. So, but I do like betting big on the turn, but not necessarily for the reasons that David mentions. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff he says about wanting to get it heads up and folding out broadways and like, that's just not stuff I'm concerned about. I'm more concerned about getting people to pay off with whatever they have. If I had a more vulnerable hand, then maybe I would have those thoughts in mind. But given the way the preflop action went, we basically have the nuts here, I think. Mm-hmm. And is not that vulnerable. At this point, a lot of people would raise club draws on the flop, especially good club draws. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of discounting some of those. So other than that, we don't have much to fear. Mm-hmm. So I'm basically hoping, even with two pair, like if somebody had ace nine, would they just call the flop? So I still think there's some pretty weak ranges. And I think one of the differences that I had on the flop is that I thought people would three bet with like ace king, ace queen. But if we're putting those type of hands in their cold calling ranges pre-flop, then I like this bet size a lot, because I think we can stack ace king, ace queen. Yeah. But other than that, I think it's going to be hard to stack people. But ace 10 now we can also stack. But I think those are enough value targets for us to choose this sizing.
Yeah, that's I like everything you said. I think everything you just said is good. I'd like to comment on something that David says, which is that he says that the 10 of diamonds makes a lot of straight draws in addition to the flush draw. And that's true. Like the 10-9 combination on the board does make a lot of hands into straight draws. My question is how many of those can call on the flop? Like if it goes bet call, I'm not sure people are peeling with queen jack or king queen or king jack or 7-6. Unless they also have a flush draw. So I'm not sure what David meant, but I wanted to point that out. And another thing that I think is very interesting about this turn is that, especially since the ace of clubs is up on the board, when you think about flush draws that can be out there, once the 10 of diamond comes, so king queen of clubs, king jack of clubs, queen jack of clubs, jack 10 of clubs, queen 10 of clubs, king 10 of clubs, then those suited connectors like 8-7 of clubs, 7-6 of clubs, and even some of the semi connectors, it's not so easy to find a flush draw that doesn't either have a pair or a straight draw to go with it. So the turn has the funny effect of turning a lot of flush draws into combination draws of some sort. And I think that affects how this hand plays. And in particular, it makes me want to think about inducing a raise a little bit more. And here's why. So I said that players sometimes call too much with ace-king or ace-queen before the flop, but I do think that people 3-bet with those hands, especially ace-king, quite a bit. And four people saw the turn. So somebody bet out, and we called, then two other people called. And they have to have something, right? Now, right. We don't have any aces, but one of the aces is on the board. So either somebody's got a flush draw, or everybody has exactly an ace, or somebody's messing around with a hand that is neither an ace nor a flush draw, which is possible. People call with tens. Like, that's a thing that happens, or nines. That's a thing that happens. It makes a big difference, I think, that it's a nine and not a 10 on the flop, because it makes all those Broadway hands not a gut shot that people can peel with. So that's a very long way of saying that I think that although people like to raise flush draws on the flop, they have to have something, and probably we disagreed a little bit on how likely a flush draw is. I think that once you get four people in on the flop, so once we have three opponents, it's pretty likely that a flush draw is out there somewhere. And here's my punchline, is that I almost want to bet an amount that is looking to get raised from a hand like King 10 of clubs, or at least I would really like to know whether King 10 of clubs, Queen Jack of clubs, hands like that will raise, because I would like to bet 3-bet against those hands. And also, if everybody has an ace, and if people are 3-betting ace king and ace queen, or especially ace king, a lot of their hand, like ace 10 and ace 9, get more likely. Like, especially if they're capable of folding ace 7 offsuit, ace 6 offsuit, hands like that. And maybe they're not, but if they are, then all of a sudden it's really likely that there's a raising hand behind us. So this 10 of diamonds, I think, is a very interesting card. It promotes a lot of flush draws to combination draws, and it also makes it likely that two pair is out there somewhere. And as such, I think that actually a check raise is not crazy, or a bet planning to 3-bet is not crazy. I don't know if you hate that. Does that make sense to you? Do you hate that?
No. It makes perfect sense. If I thought that we could induce that, that would be optimal, I think. That's something I would want to go for.
Yeah.
But one thing that I kind of, one mantra that I repeat to myself is, passive players do passive things.
Yeah, good.
And the guy who doesn't raise this flop with a flush draw is not, in my opinion, not likely to raise the turn with a flush draw. Good. If you try to induce him to do so.
Even if he has a straight flush draw? A straight draw and flush draw?
In my experience, I will say no. Like, good. I can see those guys calling.
Yeah.
And then on the river saying, I missed.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost like they kind of want to. What I've seen is the read that I get from these guys on the river is like they want to show, oh, I had so many outs and I missed. Like, they don't really think about, like I can remember Andrew saying something one time where he used to think of draws as made hands waiting to happen, and he switched and now he thinks of them as premium bluffing hands.
Yeah.
And I think passive players would think of a draw as a made hand waiting to happen. And if it doesn't happen, it gives them something to complain about. Yeah. And on the flop, we didn't really know if they were like really aggressive or really passive yet. But by the time we get to the turn, we can see that nobody's made an aggressive action. So we have a little bit more information once we get to the turn. And I think because of that, I would more so take David's line to exploit their passivity as opposed to trying to induce passive players to make an aggressive action.
Good. I think that's great. And I almost want to leave it alone, but I have to say like two more things. One is that if they're going to raise a small bet, they might raise a big bet too. And in fact, given the way the stacks are, if we make a big bet, it makes shoving a little bit more enticing. So what I said about inducing aggressive action is A, probably false, as you say, and B, even if I'm right that we can induce an aggressive action, it's not clear that being more passive ourselves will do any better at that. And also, as I said before, if you know, the more we build a pot, the more we can make later. So I think all the reasons that they might take an aggressive action are also reasons that they might call a really big bet. So I think that this is a good spot to exploitively make a big bet, because they probably have something and they're probably going to call with it, at least somebody. So good. Thank you for helping me think better than I was.
No, this is a good hand. This is a good hand.
Yeah, good. So after middle position checks, I bet $150. The cutoff holds. The button hesitates and calls. Middle position folds. The pot is $430. So 150. So there's a little bit less than a pot-sized bet behind. And we go to the river. The river is the six of clubs. So the board is ace of clubs, nine of clubs, four of spades, ten of diamonds, six of clubs. Completing the possible flush, but no straights. David, again with a set of fours. He says, I consider my options and check, trying to get to showdown. What do you think of that decision?
Let's see. Yeah, we're basically putting people squarely on flush draws and some made hands that we beat. Mm-hmm. So the question is, should we bet to get value from the made hands or check to kind of control the pot size, I guess, against the flush draws? I mean, if the guy has a flush, we lose. And if he has a made hand, he may not even pay off a bet anyway, considering that the flush got there, because a lot of times 1-3 players are very cognizant of when the third flush card comes in. So, like, if the guy has, like, ace-jack, he may not even call. We do kind of miss value against, like, two-pair and ace-queen, ace-king, I guess. So I guess the choices, I think, are between a small bet or check. I don't think these players are super capable of turning a weak made hand into a bluff, so I don't know if a blocking bet is even necessary or even useful here at all. Mm-hmm. So I guess, man, I think I like a check fold.
Interesting. Yeah, good. Interesting. I guess the question I want to ask David is, he says he's trying to get to showdown, and I guess I want to know, why do you want to get to showdown? And I imagine the answer is that he thinks he has showdown value, but he also thinks he's behind sometimes. And that's a fine answer, but I wonder whether checking is the best response to that or not. It seems to me that on the turn, there are plenty of combinations of ace-10 and ace-9, or maybe even 10-9, but I think more likely there are hands like some flush draws, especially given that flush draws tend to have something else on the turn. I think he can call with them, and I think that's why my previous comment about combinatorics is relevant here. A lot of flush draws have something, and probably enough to call with on the turn, at least in their minds. So I do think that that the opponent can have a flush here, but I also think that ace-queen, ace-jack, ace-10, ace-9 are all possible too, and I think that we risk missing value from those hands. So I'm tempted to bet fold this river. It's just a bit of a combinatorial thing. We don't block any of those hands. There aren't that many flushes, I don't think. And I think we can bet fold. So I'm tempted to bet like 165 and fold to a raise. Does that make sense, or do you think that's too ambitious?
I don't necessarily know if it's too ambitious. I will say that at this point, I'm not giving anybody Ace Nine. I think okay. Ace Nine would have spoken up by now,
good.
Considering a multi-way pot with two clubs out there. I think maybe even Ace Nine checks raised the flop. So the question is, the weaker aces, Ace Jack, Ace Queen, Ace Eight, stuff like that, what they call the 165, if we let the river. I think so. I mean, yeah. Again, this is like, you know, the flip side of that statement I made earlier, you know, people that like to call want to call.
Yeah.
So I guess it does make sense. Like anybody that called two streets here with like an ace eight is probably not going to fold it to a small bet on the river. So yeah, I think I definitely would either check fold or bet fold. And I'm kind of coming around and I kind of like the bet if we think we can get called by one pair ace hands. And just thinking about, you know, what we've seen from these players so far, I think that's the case. So yeah, I like a bet on the river.
Oh, good. So amusingly enough, your reasoning for a bet almost talked me into a check. So I think everything that you said is great. And I guess I think this is a really opponent dependent spot. I think I play against a lot of people who, when we bet 150 on the turn, and this is a really important part of this hand, when we overbet the turn, it's going to make them react. Like, I think it's going to fold out the ace eight a lot of the time, and it may even fold out the ace jack. But as I said, it's just a quirk of the way this board ran out that a lot of the flush draws pick something up. So, you know, if like king, queen of clubs, king, jack, king, 10, queen, jack, queen, 10, jack, 10, if all those hands are still there, you know, 10, 8, you know, 8, 7, 7, 6, whatever. If all of those hands are still there, and if we folded out a lot of the aces, and if a lot of the other aces would have raised either on the flop or pre-flop, like ace nine and ace four, you think would have spoken up on the flop or the turn.
Yes.
Ace king or ace queen might have spoken up pre-flop, especially ace king. Then ace jack, like some people will just fold the river. Now I'm starting to think that against some opponents, flushes make up a bigger part of their range, and especially a bigger part of their calling range. Or not folding range than I thought. So I'm starting to think that David's check is. I see your reasoning for betting, and against a vanilla 1-3 opponent, I probably still find a bet here. But I think it's closer than I initially thought, and I really like everything that you said, and I think I was probably overlooking the fundamental fact that you emphasized, which is just that passive players, like players who like to call, really like to call. They don't like to raise and they don't like to fold.
I mean, like, just generally look at what people do often and expect them to do that in the future. Like, very few people are trying to mix up their game. But I mean, I like what you said about counting the combos. I'm interested though, like this, the guy that we're facing is the button, right? So there's a limp, we raise, cutoff calls, and then this guy calls on the button. I mean, I don't want to project my nittiness on this guy, but I'm not calling with every combination of club draws out there, given that action. So with the ace and the nine being on the board, that's going to block a lot of my club combos that I'm calling with preflop. A lot of the, pretty much any of the Broadway stuff, and maybe like 8-7 suited, 6-5 suited, but I'm not calling with like three gap suited combos, but if we feel like this type of, if this player is calling with, you know, almost any two suited cards in this spot, then I think that does put, that may, you know, lean him more towards having flushes in this spot, which means that I guess checking would be better against a guy like that. But against a guy like me, who's more likely to have ace 10 here than like 7-3 of clubs, maybe it's better to bet fold against me.
Yeah, that makes sense. I also think it's important how that person plays flush draws later. I think a lot of people who are playing the 7-deuce of clubs are not folding it even for a big bet on the turn. So I think what you say is good. I do think that in at least some players' hands, some of the miscellaneous club draws, like 6-5 of clubs, would just fold on the turn for the over bet and not want to invest like, you know, 50 big blinds.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and I think, again, I think that's why the board texture is interesting, because a lot of the sort of premium preflop clubs now have some sort of combination draw on the turn. But David checks. The river tanks and the button tanks and finally bets $165. I call. Well, first, what do you want to do here?
If I check and he bets, I'm folding.
Good. Good, good, good. I actually think, given everything I've just said, I actually think this is a place where a fold should at least be considered. Betting 165 into 430, I have to be very, very confident before I can fold. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I have to think that this person, yeah, I mean, there are like a full nine combinations of ace 10, maybe. Sometimes people don't raise ace 9 on the flop. We bet so much that two pair might not raise on the turn. So like a hand like ace 4, we would want, I mean, there's only three combinations of ace 4, but I would want to be really sure that in my read on the player. However, some people who could have ace 9 here could also be value betting like 3-9s or 3-10s, and there are three combinations each or some fraction. Probably not full combinations of both of those. But my point is, getting better than 3-1, getting like 3.5-1, I would want to have a really good read on this player before I fold a set getting 3-1 on the river. That said, I think that for all the reasons we've described, a fold here is much more defensible than it would usually be. And I like your reasoning for a fold. Probably against like a totally unknown 1-3 opponent, I would, or even somebody unknown except for what we know in David's description, I think I would call against that player, but I do think it's a bit of a crying call. And David says, I call, and he shows 10-4 of clubs. He had picked up two pair on the turn to go with his flush draw. So, well, we've already said what we think about the hand, and Carlos pretty much crushed it throughout, so thanks for sharing what you think. Is there anything else you want to say about this hand?
No, actually that is, but I'm trying to be good. I kind of want to berate the button missing. I would never do this out loud in person, but if I'm sitting at this table, I don't even know if I would say nice hand. I'd probably just like tap the table and muck, but in my head, I'd be thinking like, 10-4.
Yeah, I mean, that said, he made, you know, 10-4 clubs. That's not a good decision for the $12 preflop bet. But on the flop, he had a pair and a flush draw. It's either a call or a raise. On the turn, two pair and a flush draw. I would not fold in his spot.
Agreed.
And then on the river, he has a flush. So, you know, the first $12 was not great. But after that, he did okay.
That's fair.
He flopped really well. I think he flopped really well, and he turned really well, and he rivered really well. So, that's just a nasty hand to 1-3 poker for you.
Yeah, for sure. It's rough out there, man.
All right, so we have caught up with Carlos, and we have talked about two strategy hands, and I hope you'll be safe going across the country. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No, I will kind of give... So, what is it? The 28th of May is when I'll be heading out. And so, if I can remember this correctly, I'll kind of give you my itinerary.
Okay, great.
So, starting out in Atlanta, you're going to go Birmingham, Memphis, Little Rock, Oklahoma City. What's next? Oh, wherever Choctaw is. I know it's near Durant, I think is what it's called.
Yeah, Durant, Oklahoma.
And then from there, back up to 40, Oklahoma City, and then Amarillo, which apparently there's nothing to do in Amarillo. Like, I looked online, like I couldn't find a casino. Apparently there's no, you can't play No Limit Texas Hold'em in a casino in the state of Texas.
Yep.
So I'll be in Amarillo, I guess, staring at sand dunes or something. and then Albuquerque and Flagstaff and then Vegas. So if there's any Thinking Poker listeners or Tournament Poker Edge members in those cities, I should be, you know, coming through your area within the next week or so.
Fantastic. And I hope you will be as safe as you can possibly be. And I hope to see plenty of you when I'm out in Vegas in July.
Sounds good, Nate.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Carlos. Have a great week.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Ocean of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into